Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Okay. I have just finished a long day of work, and I'm going to ease into episode 18 of the Greenwich podcast. Play the intro.
I'm a Greek Australian. That's why I look like this, but I sound like this.
I've had an eventful week. I am acquiring an apartment in Greece. And let me tell you, it's really time-consuming. I don't know what it is with Greek people and fighting over Greekness, but for people living here, because people who live in Greece generally fight a bit less about who's Greek and Greekness, but they still go over the top with it. Greeks who don't live in Greece, I live in Greece, are obsessed with this idea of purity. And you know what? Let's talk about it, because there's something I think is a bit weird about this purity idea. Now, this episode is, we're going to go through my family tree, which is something that everyone has been fucking obsessed with for a long time. But I actually paid a genealogist to go through my family tree, and I, with all the sources, catalogued everything. I paid a good little sum of money for that. And then I went and did even further research that led me literally across the Mediterranean. So it was really a lot of fun. And as a, you know, wannabe historian, I had a cracking time doing it. I have just found in Greece, growing up in a, you know, in a Greek community in Sydney, and then traveling the world, meeting Greeks, living in Cyprus for a period and living in Athens for many years, everyone is competing to be more Greek. And then complaining about how bad Greece is. So are you proud to be something you're not proud of? What? I don't know. For me personally, if you ask me, George, what do you feel? Do you feel Australian? Do you feel Greek? Because I always feel like, a lot of my friends are like, why do you act like you're not Australian, right? Let me tell you, I don't feel Australian. I don't know, I know one thing for sure, okay? I don't really give a fuck about being in big groups. I don't like groups. I really don't like groups. I don't like team sports, generally, because, to be honest, and this is obviously colored by my life experiences, I've had to depend on myself my whole life. You know, in my bad times, many of which I've had, it was me who got me out of them. No one helped. I've had good friends, but at the end of the day, you know, friends can only do so much. They have their own lives and families to take care for. And I get that. And they do what they can, but you have to be there to save yourself. And above all else, before I am an entrepreneur, before I'm a comedian, before I'm an Australian, before I'm a Greek, before I'm a capitalist, before I'm a this or that or an Orthodox, before I am anything, I am an individual, right? I am me, you know? I don't represent, I'm not an elected official. I don't represent anything other than George Moulos. And this idea, this group mentality, this mob mentality, this national mentality, I start with, if I don't have control over it, don't judge me about it or, you know, with it, you know? And identity politics and identity is such a crazy thing in our generation. Like, you know, we don't need to get into it, but like, holy shit, is it crazy, this identity world. However, it's always been a human thing to want to know who you are. For me, I think my biggest strength in my life is that I've always known who I am. You know, even when I was 13, I was playing internet, you know, business games. I knew who I was. I know at my core who I am. I remember actually, I remember having dreams where I wasn't myself when I was a kid, like very, very young. I'm like, you know, I was a coward in my dreams when I was like 5, 6, or 7, or 8. I remember I'd have scary dreams and I'd be scared, basically. And then as I grew up, as I went into my teens, I started to be who I am now in my dreams. So my subconscious would make decisions. Like if there was a fucking lion in my dream, I would fight the lion. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, I would do shit like that. And like I have a lot of dreams. Like, I think it's because when I started to eat clean, like mainly carnivore diet, I would have the best dreams. I would wake up, I'm like, I'm so cool in my dreams. I'm a legend in my dreams. Never, you know, backing down for a fight, always being a hard worker, like having integrity. Like, in my dreams, I'm a legend. And what I'm saying is, in my core, in my subconscious even, I know who I am. And I think anyone who knows me in any degree, or in any degree of knowing me, my closest friends from Sylvania Heights, the primary school that I went to in Australia, my family, friends I've known for a couple years, people who find me on the internet or come to a comedy show. I think even if you just get one reel or one performance of stand-up for 5 minutes, you got a kind of a good idea that, hey, this is a good guy who works hard and likes to have some fun. Like, that's kind of me, you know? I will never do anything bad to someone, but I'm going to have some fun, you know? And I work hard. Life isn't too more complicated than that. Obviously, a big part of my life is being Greek. In Australia, growing up in Australia, I was always the Greek or the Wog, which is, you know, these days a term of endearment, but a racial slur. For immigrants in Australia that are like Italian and Greek and Arab. Leaving Australia, that's when I really was like, oh shit, apparently I'm not Australian or Greek, you know? And I have this cool, I don't know if it's cool, you tell me. I have this bit that I actually started out my comedy career with, saying, you know, I grew up in Australia, thinking I was white by default, but then I realized I'm not. I traveled around the world, they thought I was Mexican, they thought I was this, I was that, blah, blah, blah. But above all, they thought I was a criminal. And when I go back to Australia. And there's definitely a racial... Like, again, like I thought I was white. I'm not black. I'm not African. I'm not sub-Saharan. But in the West, in the Anglo-Saxon West, in the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant West, I'm never considered white. In Greece, of course, most people just like, yeah, of course you're Greek, Malaka. But then there's Greeks, mainly on the internet, mainly who don't live in Greece, who are like, you're not Greek enough. You don't, bro, who gives a fuck? Who cares? Why are you so obsessed with my genealogy? That's weird. That's creepy. And of course, you know, I always talk about the geopolitics of Greece and Turkey because it's a real thing that we have to deal with. Turks and Greeks, our history, especially modern history, is built around nationalism. So what is true and what we want to be true sometimes are two very different things. At the end of the day for me, like I've been saying, I'm George Moulos, you know, and my work speaks for itself. My actions and my work speaks for itself. My portfolio of work, whether it's a little project like Marching Across Greece, whether it's my businesses that I've built, whether it's my stand-up comedy, whether it's content, it speaks for itself. You are what you repeatedly do. I repeatedly do dope shit. Simple as that, right? I don't really care about being Greek. It's just that I am. and I love it. I'm going to keep representing Greece in the best way I can, which I think is by doing dope shit. Malaga, there you go. and performing at the best of my ability, which I can't say for a lot of the people who keep complaining on the internet. But that's the internet. You know, if you want to be a creator, don't go crying around that, you know, it's tough out there making videos. Just don't look at it. Who gives a shit? But, of course, we have a bunch of information to go through. I have a few articles. Some of it is pretty terrible for Greece, for Greeks. But I will say a bit of an update for my life because, you know, this is my little podcast. I have acquired an apartment. I am moving in a few days here in Athens. I'm going to make a video about a video series, maybe even a course, about how to buy a, did I say buy a business? Buy a house, buy an apartment in Greece, because it's a process and it's not very, you know, it is not, this is the best way to describe it. Buying an apartment or property in Greece isn't laid out. It's not explained as clearly as a Westerner would want it to be. Like, I could give someone a 5-page book about the process and it would clear up 90% of it with a timeline and everything. Like, it's actually not that difficult, but since you're left in the dark all the time, it is extremely difficult. I'm going to buy a car, you know, I'm doing the whole process. And of course, all my friends are accountants and lawyers because of my business, so I'm well informed. But yeah, that's my life update. I've been sick for about a month, so I've just recovered and I'm snapping back into work. But yeah, I'm very excited. I think I started this podcast only a few months ago, obviously. But I started this podcast at a time in my life when I was just deciding to settle down, location-wise, not romantically. And it is very difficult. I have not lived in one city for 90 days straight without traveling since I was 18 years old. Or 19. And I'm 26 now. I'm turning 27. So, like, I did a good stretch of this digital nomad stuff. But yeah, if I know anything in my life, I know that I'm good at stopping something I know doesn't work. And the digital nomad thing, you know, works for a while, but it doesn't work for me anymore. So that's my life update. I'm settling down in Greece. Gonna have to do the army at some point, which I'm kind of excited for. You know, I'll reference it here. Like I said, I went to like a military school in Australia and I fucking loved it. I mean, I think the Newington College cadets might be a bit more serious than the Greek army that I'm going to go into because they're going to put me into, you know, the lowest rung. And, well, I think it has less funding, you know, per capita than Newington College. But that is what it is. That's my life update. I think that's it. I'm cracking into a lot of work. Now let's get into some of the topics that have come from you guys, from the audience, and also from the news and myself. If you have some topics that you want me to review, send them my way. I'm very interested. I love learning. So let's get into it. The first thing I wanted to talk about is, I mean, it would be ridiculous for me to, you know, consider myself a historian or a current day historian and not, you know, look and talk about what's happening with Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Now, I have, you know, looked up to Elon Musk most of my life because he was just an entrepreneur. But when an entrepreneur gets into politics or when a rapper gets into this or an actor gets into that, you know, when comedians get into acting, people change their careers or do multiple things. You need to evaluate it for what it's worth. Like, I'm doing entrepreneurship, I'm also doing comedy. I might not be a good comedian. I might be a good entrepreneur, right? But you have to evaluate those things individually, I guess. So Elon Musk is a bit crazy when it comes to the political side, but a lot of what he's doing with the Doge, I think is a good idea. I mean, maybe the transparency isn't there. I haven't done too much research, but I think that's going to come, you know, in the process, but cutting down on stupid spending. I mean, yeah, that sounds good. However, what I'm talking about today is, can you imagine a department of government waste? what's called, what's DOGE stand for? Oh, efficiency. Can you imagine a Department of Government Efficiency in Greece? Can you imagine how much, how the expenses that would be cut from a DOGE going through the Greek government? Firstly, you need to call it the Kryptea. The Kryptea was a secret group in Sparta that would like police it. It was like a secret police. It's the Gestapo. I mean, is DOGE like the Gestapo? I don't know. I mean, Gestapo is Nazis. It's like the KGB. I don't know which is worse. Maybe this is a bad reference, but I don't know. Just imagine a watchdog within Greece done by someone who obviously knows how to build corporations and teams. Can you imagine just the waste that would find? The malakias that they would find across the Greek government. Oh my lord. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people would lose their jobs. But the real thing to mention here is that Greek government employment isn't about productivity. It's about making sure that hundreds of thousands of people have jobs. Just so that they have jobs, right? It's not necessarily about them being productive. The government just wants them to have jobs, or they want themselves to have jobs. And in Greece, there's this thing called rentierism. Rentierism, what's the exact definition? A state which derives all or a substantial portion of its national revenues from rent or indigenous resources or external clients. So rentierism, rentier capitalism, for example, I get elected to government and then I hire all my friends as my team. Now they aren't, it's nepotism, you know, even if they're just my friends, well, nepotism is for family. My friends, I just employ them. So everyone, a lot of people, I don't know the numbers, there's probably a number. There are a lot of people who have jobs in the Greek government, in the police, in this, in that, in every government department in Greece and in the world. But in Greece, it's much higher, probably the highest in Europe, where people have jobs because they know their boss, right? And so a DOGE of Greece, a Department of Government Efficiency in Greece would tear a hole in this economy and save a lot of money that and make and ridiculously increase unemployment that you couldn't imagine, I think. I thought it was worth mentioning. Can you imagine? Do you remember that video of Argentinian president Javier Miguel, I forget his last name, with the afuera. He has all the government's departments of government. I mean, there are a lot of Greek government departments that do fucking nothing, okay? Just, you know how he saw he's like, Department of Museums, Antiquities, afuera. Department of Rocks on the, afuera, afuera. Can you imagine how much afuera, how much throwing away out that you could do with Greek governments, Greek government departments? Oh my God. And it feels like it's right there because we've made the money, we've paid the tax revenues, now we're spending the tax revenues, right? It is our money. We've paid the taxes, right? And you're like, if we just don't waste it, maybe, I don't know, we can spend more money on the people. Maybe we can spend more money on infrastructure. Maybe we can pay off all the debts that we're dying and having insane interest rates. So anyway, that's just my idea. I don't know. It's just not even an idea, just a hypothesis of, a Department of Government Efficiency for Greece. It'd be brutal. Second thing to talk about, I've been reading up about what's happening in Syria. I can't believe that Assad is gone and that it wasn't a complete bloodbath. What does it mean for Greece? Is the question I always ask. Anytime I see geopolitical news, I'm like, what does this mean for Greece? What does it mean for Greece? What does it mean for Greece? Syria has pretty much opened the doors to Turkey. Now, for Greece, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I think anytime Turkey is not looking in our direction to cause trouble is a good thing. Turkey, like I've said in many podcasts, Turkey is more concerned with its eastern frontier than the west at all. Like, they're not worried about nor what's happening in Ukraine and Russia, really. I mean, it's not going to affect the borders of Turkey. Bulgaria, Greece, Cyprus, they're not too worried. Okay, Cyprus, they're a bit more worried than Greece. But honestly, from what I'm seeing from recent news and recent research, Turkey's relations with Greece have never been better. Like, ever. And Greece is benefiting financially. So, the advancement of Turkish ambitions in Syria, I think the only real loser are the Kurds, which I don't think is good. I do believe in a Kurdistan, but what are you going to do? So yeah, that's the update in Syria for Greece. What does it mean? We're going to have to wait and see, but it's good for Turkey, basically, which, you know, is what it is. Let's head to our next topic. So, luckily, one of you guys sent me this because I want to quote it. Spirit or Autonaut Aeronautical Systems, Multicopters and Ground Stations. Now, this is I'm just looking at the Instagram page because this is what I was sent. This is a Greek drone company. Wow. Now, first thing to mention is Greece's biggest enemy, whether you like it or not, is not coming from the north, it's not coming from the west, it's not coming from the south. It is coming from Turkey, which is a NATO ally. Say what you want. There is a defense budget, and we have to say, where does this budget go? So it's obviously going to be against a hypothetical Turkish attack. Turkey has some of the best fucking drones in the world, right? Greek drones, by the look of it, shoot rockets. Not as good or even in the realm of Turkey's drones. These are drones that shoot rockets. The payload isn't huge. But say what you want. I'm going to research this a bit more. One thing, when it comes to the Greek defense industry, private companies or companies that are innovating and producing, it's basically been gutted in the last 50 years, which is not a good thing. I think it's a bad thing. So I'm going to do a deep dive on the military companies within Greece and the defense industry in Greece. Now, look, is this an advancement for Greece? Yeah. You know, this specific company looks like it's doing something pretty interesting. On the global scale, obviously, it's behind, but man, it's something, you know? So I'm really happy to see that. So let's look at what is next on our list of items to review. Oh, yes, this is very interesting. So this YouTuber got an inside look at another defense company in Greece. Now, this is called the Minotaur. This army vehicle breaks down drones. Now, with the war in Ukraine, we have seen, of course, the very, very fast, almost the exponential advancement of drone technology in war. Now, like I've mentioned many times, Turkey has some of the best drones, military drones, in the world, with Baykar. So on the other side, with every weapon, another industry, the defense of that weapon, against that weapon, is created. So we're looking at a Greek company, and Konstantinos Soukos. And, I mean, let's firstly talk about what we've seen in the field. What we've seen in the field are Russian tanks, which were woefully unprepared for Ukrainian drones, create, what's the word? Makeshift defenses against Ukrainian drones. And they simply haven't been working. And Ukrainian drones have been advancing and innovating faster than Russians can build these makeshift drones, makeshift defenses on their tanks. So what we're looking at now is a Greek company who's created an anti-drone tank, right? So this guy obviously has a great history in the industry. I'm going to do a bit of a deep dive as to his background. But I want to dive into what this Minotaur is and its abilities. I I like that he's dressed like an arms dealer. He's not trying to hide it. Oh, wow. So, yeah, he does. His company produces multiple different arms. Yep, he's made US ambassadors. I want to learn about this Minotaur, man. Let's get into it. So, obviously, the Minotaur just has... I mean, I'd love to look at the specs. I'll do a separate video on that. But it has... Firstly, it's black, which it's not camouflage, but I think you can come in any color. Once they're probably like 5 mil each, 10 mil each. I think the standard tank, American tank, is like in the tens of millions. But yeah, this shoots down drones, and also it has the armor. Let's take a bit of a closer look. So yeah, radars. There you go. A lot of the radars and equipment on the top of the tank, of the Minotaur, is focused on disrupting the signal between it and the drone that allows it to be connected to the driver. Because the amazing thing about these Ukrainian drones, for example, is the accuracy. They can go in small gaps in the tanks to attack the crew, and under certain pieces of armor, and hit fuel tanks, for example. So this Minotaur obviously has radars that can try and disrupt it. And again, the offensive side, the offensive drones, will look for ways to get around that. So obviously this is, it's in collaboration with a few different other Western companies, but they are focused more on the disruption of the signal and bring the drone down before it actually hits the vehicle. It does seem like a huge, huge piece of equipment, and I wonder just how expensive this Minotaur is. I don't think it's going to be like, this is a $40 million thing at the end. I don't think there's a final price tag on this video. It's not like buying a car. But yeah, they are using laser technology to shoot down these drones. That is pretty damn impressive. Holy shit. He gave a live demonstration. I love how arms companies are just like, and this is how it works. Here's a live demonstration. That's pretty awesome. But I wonder how... I mean, that's a huge fucking laser to put on a tank. How many tanks can you put that on? Cool. Okay. I mean, is the interconnection of Greece with Cyprus and Egypt for electricity, which is kind of crazy as a concept, but it's been actually in talks and in the works for quite some time. And this is the most recent report. So we're talking about the GREGY interconnection, the interconnection between Greece and Egypt. Now, they always, you know, come out with some news about the progress report meetings, about essentially the provision of cheap energy and green energy from renewable sources to Egypt, an exporter of Greece being an exporter of electricity. Now, look, I'm all for this. Obviously, Greece and Egypt have I wouldn't call it an alliance, but essentially it's... they have a bit of an alliance, I guess, against Turkey. And this is mainly because of Libya. So there's a civil war in Libya. Greece and Egypt are on one side of it, supporting one side of it, and Turkey supporting the other. Now, Libya supports Turkey's EEZ, economic exclusive economic zone, their sea map. What they think is their rights to the sea, because I'll put it up here on screen, but Turkey thinks they own the entire Eastern Mediterranean and completely does away with the international laws regarding seas. They're just like, oh yeah, the Greek islands, Greece technically owns the islands because of the Lausanne Treaty, but also we own every single inch of water around it. So like, as soon as that grain of sand finishes at the Greek beach, you're in Turkish waters. Like, there was this meme about how, like, Turkish eat, there is no limit to, like, you know, to the Turkish EEZ, right? So, like, water around Iceland, that's Turkish, right? Because it's the continental shelf, dude. It just keeps going. And even though Libya doesn't, it's not even close to Turkey, not even in the same realm of Turkey, they're like, we have an EEZ border. And because the civil war in Libya, they're just like, one side of the civil war in Libya, just like, whatever, sure, Turkey wants to help us, give us some money, give us some guns, sure, we'll sign some fucking paper about some water. Who gives a shit? So on the other side is Greece, Cyprus, and Egypt, and at times, Israel. And this Euro-Africa interconnector, essentially, that goes through the island of Crete with a high-voltage direct current submarine cable the length of around 1,400 kilometers. Around the length of my Guinness World Record walk across Greece. It's 200 kilometers further, to be honest. So Egypt will be connected to Cyprus, which is a 500-kilometer cable, and Cyprus will be connected to Crete through a 898-kilometer cable. To be basically providing to the pan-European electricity grid. The length depth of the cable will be 3,000 meters undersea in areas between Cyprus and Crete. Now, if you look at the map here, you can see that where they're laying it is quite strategic because they want to keep it in the EEZ of Greece and Cyprus and not into anybody else's EEZ. So obviously, you know, this is just another step in the geopolitical war games, let's call it, of the Eastern Mediterranean. And the funny character that is in the middle of all of this is a little known island called Castellorizo, because it is a tiny, to be fair, insignificant island that is the furthest eastern part of Greece. And there's another island to its east that's even smaller, but it's uninhabited. But it's the most eastern current-day Greeks in the Greek borders, let's say. And it's actually part of Asia, which makes Greece cross two continents. Not, you know, through Constantinople like we usually would, but through Castellorizo. And because Castellorizo is there, it creates a very odd map that really sucks for Turkey. But hey, bro, you shouldn't have signed the Lausanne Treaty. And unless you want to cede all that land in Thrace. Sorry, Matty. But you're going to have to live with it. I mean, you got the best deal with the Lausanne Treaty. Why are you crying? It's a bit of fucking water. We're not going to find any gas anyway, knowing our luck. But yeah, that's that. So that's that piece of news. We'll see how that progresses. They just keep giving updates. I want to know when it's done, right? Actually, my first cousin, works on a ship that lays electricity cable, but in the North Sea. But anyway, I wanted to go through this video. I thought this video was incredible by a very small YouTube channel with about 11,000 views that is basically based off this book called 200 Buildings in the 200-year anniversary from the Greek Independence War, which goes through the architecture of Athens. Athens is my city. I love it. And I love the architecture here, even though it's, you know, a mess. It's a mess. Obviously, this is a book I want to buy because it's gorgeous. This book goes through some of the most famous buildings from each era. And for people in Athens, who even live in Athens, who visit Athens, that, you know, you don't get the best idea of Athens if you just go to the center, or if you just go to the archaeological sites that are Golden Age or Hellenic Age Greece. Obviously, that stuff is awesome. And to be fair, it's better because they were quite wealthy, those little Athenian boys. This goes through some of the most famous buildings from each architectural age. Now, the first one I want to go into is not the Parliament building, which was a palace, is not the Kapodistrian University building, but my famous, my favorite one is the, I mean, there's so many good ones here, it's crazy. But look how beautiful the National Technical University of Athens is. Now, this is a very famous university. It's the most famous university in Greece. And it is, you can't talk about the modern history of Greece without talking about this university. But my favorite building, my favorite underrated building in Athens is the Byzantine Museum, which was used to be a house, but now it's a Byzantine and Christian Museum. I think it's a beautiful building. Like, if I was to build a building in Dithira, it would be that one. So, next building, let's talk, and this is maybe my favorite age in terms of style, which is, this age is 1968 to 1922, which is a broad range. But it's the most Parisian, it's the most, even Austro-Hungarian kind of look, that the look that you see in like Austria-Hungary. It has this, I mean, no surprise, a lot of the architects were Austrian and German. So the Zapion is a great example. Gorgeous building, and it's still used to this day. The beautiful Numismatic Museum, minus the swastikas. He didn't know. Yes, a German guy owned it and built it. However, this was pre-World War II. But I obviously love that museum too because it's numismatic. This beautiful, the Piraeus Municipal Theater. Mwah! Amazing building. Look at that marble. Wow. I don't know why they didn't flute the columns. They should flute those columns. The National Theater. This is another underrated building. National Theater. This is in Omonia. Gorgeous building. Amazing building. Look at, and that's what they, in this book, they mentioned that the side of this theater is how Hadrian's library looked. You know, almost exactly. And then there's all these other gorgeous buildings. These gorgeous, gorgeous buildings. Some of them, you know, that are famous, like Maria Callas's house. But this is, you know, coming into the modern age, interwar period, post-war, world war period. And we're coming into the age of the Polykatikia. I mean, the modern, looking at Athens today, is the story of the Polykatikia and the story of a refugee city. People look at Athens as this ancient city. Athens died. Athens in 1800 basically didn't exist. It probably had the same population as Kythira, my little bullshit island that no one even knows, right? And now it's home to like 5 million people, even more, in my metropolitan area. And all the refugees that, you know, from the wars, from the independence wars that came to Athens had to be housed. All the people that came to, just from rural the rural Greece to come to Athens had to be housed. They were looking for work. And all the Asia Minor refugees, and from all the Balkan wars, from the world wars, Athens is a refugee city. Refugee, Greek refugees, nonetheless. But yes, it's a refugee city, and then you just see it's this Polykatikia that housed us all. So pretty incredible. But yeah, that's a great little video, and we will clip that and put it on Instagram. Let's go to, you know what, I paid a genealogist $1,000 to do my full family tree, and in this 250-page book is all my family tree. The earliest remnants, ideas of my family tree start in about 1200 in Sparta, in Crete, in Constantinople, and in Venice, if you can believe it. I've selected and created my own, what would you call it, blazon, family, I forget what it's called, symbol. The lambda of Lacedaemonia, Sparta, Laconia, the Venetian St. Mark's Lion, the Greek Navy, which my grandfather, my great-grandfather served in, and of course, the Palaeologian East Roman Empire flag, because of my family from Constantinople. So I've added a foreword here. Obviously, it's long, but essentially what I've written here with the genealogist is that the records for my family in Kythira, which are extremely accurate, basically because Kythira was never properly conquered by Turkey, the Ottomans, sorry. And so the Venetians, because the Venetians conquered it, which was much better, but still conquest, and essentially everyone was serfs under the Venetians. However, say what you want about North Italians, they know how to keep church records. So the church records basically went all the way to about 1500, which is ridiculously accurate, ridiculously impressive. And then beyond from 1500 further back, I've roughly estimated and essentially tried to connect all the names in my family tree from 1500 to 1450. Now, you might say, George, how can you, you know, these jumps are jumps. I 100% agree. The accuracy is much lower for the pre-1450 and pre-1500, pre-Columbian tree here. So I'm guilty of that, 100%. However, Kythira was basically empty in 1500 because Barbarossa, a famous Ottoman pirate or general or whatever you want to call him, came and pretty much genocided everyone. And so he had to be repopulated. There were some Kythians who survived, but he had to be, and it was a possession of Venice. They were all massacred, and then Venice wanted to repopulate it with people from its other holding in Crete. Now, who did they bring? And how did I find this out? I went to Venice, booked meetings with archivists and paid them, and went into the yearly censuses, sensei, of Venice in Gandia, or Crete, or not Gandia, Candia, the city, Heraklion today, and essentially found a lot of the names of my family that were in Kythira that were moved to Kythira by Venetians from the Venetian holding of Candia in Crete. And what did I find? I found a bunch of names. And the great thing about Venice, I mean, I fucking love Venice for this. I always loved Venice. I've been like five times now. Is that they kept records of, maybe this is racism, they kept records of where these families that were in Crete and that moved to Kythira, where they came from. So in this book, I see where these, so that's essentially where it took me. So here, for example, you can see these are some of the screenshots of the census, the Venetian census of Candia in the 1500s and the 1400s. And here it will say Casate, which is family name, Venardo. And the Patrie, where they're from, Italiano. So Venardo, which is actually a common name in Kythira, and then, of course, where these immigrants went, which is Australia, which is in my family tree, actually comes from Candia, which says here, Nobili del Consiglio della Città Metropoli di Candace. I can't speak Italian. It's not even Italian. It's Venetian. But yeah, so, and this was a shock to me when I found this, right? But I'm part Italian, right? And then, of course, to preface all this, I have done a DNA test, and yes, Italian Greek is what I've come, which everyone in Kythira is basically Italian Greek. So again, Patria Italiano, which was the shock that I'm part Italian. Other Italian names are Casimati, Coroneo, and Comino, which actually are quite common names in Italy. Well, not common, but they are names in Italy. There's actually a house, quite a noble family in Venice called Venardo, which is mind blowing. Now, the other part of the Cretan Venetian holdings, which is super interesting, is, of course, the fall of Constantinople happens in 1453. And a lot of those Greeks left who were in Constantinople. We're only talking about like 50,000 people, right? But a lot of those Greeks were sold into slavery or left and immigrated. And they went, a lot of them, to the only part of Greece that wasn't occupied by the Turks in the next 50 years, which was Crete. Crete only fell hundreds of years later, like 150, 200 years later. So a lot of the names in this Venetian census of Crete are, for example, Logothetis, Stratigo, Megalokonomo, and Diakakis, right? Now, a lot of these names come from Constantinople and actually appear in the late East Roman period, 1261 to 1453, as positions, and they relate to positions in the church and in the army. So there's ranks in the army, which is Stratigo. There's ranks in the church, like in the Orthodox Church, like Logotheti. And essentially what we found in this census, again, was we'd find a name like Stratigo, which is my first cousin's name, Stratigo, because his dad's from Milopotamo. I said, Casate, name, Stratigo. Patri, where they're from? Constantinopolitano. and then of course the name that, you know, always stuck out to me, which shocked me. I've been a history nerd since I was a kid, is Notaras. I've known Notaras my whole life. I went just down the road, 5-minute drive from my house where I grew up, is a fish shop called Notaras. And I always knew they were Kithirian. And in Kithira, there's heaps of Notaras. Everyone knows them, right? Then I dived into the Notaras connections through the Notaras family and its Italian connections, which a German Instagrammer did a dissertation on. What are those things in university called? I can't even think. And essentially, they had the Notaras family started in Monevasia, and they expanded because they conquered Kithira from Venice and left some family, and they basically dominated trade between Kithira, Monevasia, Sparti, Mistras, and Crete. And so they had family all over, and then a lot of that family went to Constantinople. Now, am I directly connected to Lucas Notaras? No. but in a roundabout way. Because my family tree, so that's the preface. That's the pre 1500s family tree. So it comes from Constantinople, which of course we don't have records except for like the most famous names. It comes from Monevasia, and Venice, and it all comes to Candia in this census, and then it goes to Kithira, which is me. And then nothing happened for like 500 years. No one did anything in Kithira. And the Kithira was conquered Venice was conquered by the French, Napoleon, and then they were defeated by the English at the Battle of Waterloo. And the English had Kithira for 50 years and they gave it to the new Greece. And that was most of my family. Now, my dad's mom doesn't come from Kithira. She comes from Lichia, which is near Monevasia in Laconia. And this is my family tree. And this is the pedigree chart. This is where it all begins. Of course, it begins with me, my parents, and then it branches out. Now, it immediately gets interesting with my great grandfathers on both sides of my family, both served on the famous Averrof. And I'm like, that can't be true, because my uncle told me, and he always says big stories. And then I went to the Averrof archives, which was very time consuming in the Greek Navy, and it was true. and they served at the same time that the Averrof was in Constantinople. And I'm like, wait a second. And the guy showing me the records was not impressed by all this. I go, wait a second. At the end of the Balkan War, World War, at the end of the Asia Minor campaign, or disaster, tragedy, my great-grandfathers are on the most famous Greek ship in Constantinople, or when it started even, that war. So the last person, the last Greek ship captain was Lucas Notaras in 1453, because he was the head of the navy. And that was the last Greek ship in Constantinople. And the first Greek warship in Constantinople. Since then, was also my family. The Avedov. That's pretty sick. And when I went to Constantinople, and I was sitting there, near the Hagia Sophia, I was like, this is crazy. So if I go back 1, 2, 3, 4 generations, I have a Gerani Notara, who was born in 1 December 1889. And then I have many names here. I'll only mention those ones that are connected to previous generations because this is actually like super personal. Kasimati, like we said, that comes from Italy. And then I can't tell you. There are so many fucking pages here. Like, look at this. Because he goes down every single tree branch. And this was the shortened version because I didn't care to find out every single family member. And then we have all of the sources, which sometimes includes where they were born, baptized, married, buried, whether they could speak, read, or write English. Like, it's insane. Like, these are all the sources, and then it has all of the links. Like, it keeps going and going. Like, some of this stuff is, for example, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, because the Mormons, right? That's the Mormons, right? Yeah, it's the Mormons. They went and did church recording in random countries, and they did that in Greece. So they went through all the church archives, and they digitized it. They wrote it down, then they digitized it. Incredible. But that's the short version, because obviously you can tell I could spend hours and hours going through my family. But I will say this to consolidate, well, to end. My last name is Moulos. which is not too far off Murlo, or Mulo, or Mule, or Bastard in Greek. Which is quite funny, because I have an exceptional family tree from an exceptional country, from an exceptional people that comes all the way from Venice, the Serene Republic, from Constantinople and the second in charge of the Roman Empire, from Sparta and Laconia, and people who've even fought in the most famous battles of modern Greek history on the Avedov. But as is life, it doesn't matter what you come from. It matters what you do with your life, because you're an individual. And all this family tree doesn't do anything for me but prove that this one quote from The Departed, which DiCaprio says, this family's always rising and falling in America. Family's always rising and falling in the empire, right? The Roman Empire, you know, where we see their ramifications even to this day. Venice, and or the Exarchate of Ravenna, which became Venice, was part of Eastern Roman Empire way longer than you'd imagine, and Constantinople. Like, we can connect our family trees. Even someone as insignificant as me, I can trace my family tree back to the Roman Empire and its remnants of, you know, even Venice. But with all that being said, you know, even the last few generations of my family tree, the last 3 or 4, were very poor from Kythera. My grandfather, George, where I get my name, came from Kythera, poor, 14, 13 years old, to Australia. And started from scratch. And then he had two kids, and his wife died from breast cancer, and he died from bone cancer a year or two later. And my mum was an orphan by the time she was like 5 or 6. And my dad was an orphan by the time he was like 7 or 8. So it wasn't a good start for me in Australia. I was lucky enough to be in Australia, have an amazing mother. But the reality is I started everything and built everything that I have on my own. So for all that family tree, I have nothing. I've taken nothing from family, which is hilarious. And in many ways, I am a bastard because I'm so severed from my family. But something about that I love. Like, I don't want the easy path. I don't want things laid out for me. Like, I don't give a shit, man. I'll work. I'm not scared of work. And I've done so many things in my life that I failed at. And then those that I succeeded at, that I'm not scared of starting from scratch. I never have been. I'm 26 now. I can't believe it. My friends are always older than me. So I always like watch them get old. I'm like, I'm not getting old. I'm 26. Shit's happening, dog. And now that I'm making big moves in my life, I'm not reevaluating, but I'm seeing how things, you know, I'm looking back at my young self, and I'm more than anything, I'm patting myself on the back for, you know, having the perseverance. I've made my mistakes, but having the perseverance, I'm proud of. And I'll leave you with this, even though I said I'll leave you with this like 10 minutes ago. I did this family tree, and I'm proud of my family tree, even though my recent family tree is not anything to be proud of, because I'm not very close with my family in Australia. I do kind of come from a broken home, and I have been very lonely in my childhood and, you know, early 20s. So for me, connecting to the past, I've always loved history, but connecting to the past personally was this incredible thing to see, you know. And the only thing I love more than reading and learning about history is creating history. So let's go create history, huh? I'll see you in the next Gringlish podcast.